Welcome to The Good, The Bad and The Dirty, The Secret Psychology of Persuasion. My name is Natalie Nahai and I'm the web psychologist. I help businesses psychologically optimize their online engagement by applying scientific rigor to their design process. In The Good, The Bad and The Dirty, I'll be sharing strategies and tools with you that you can use to enhance your online presence. Listen weekly as I share new sites, news in online persuasion, and the occasional guest star to help you convert more customers online. Make sure you subscribe for free updates at thewebpsychologist.com and get all the resources we mention in the show on the show notes page at thewebpsychologist.com/show-notes. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Good, The Bad and The Dirty. This week we've got the rare pleasure of welcoming Mark Bukowski as our guest. I met Mark at Searchlove, which is a fantastic conference that the guys over at Distilled put on every year. And he gave an enthralling talk on the power of storytelling, in which the star of the show was a tap dancing dog, but we're going to come to that in a moment. Firstly, a bit of an introduction. So for those of you who haven't heard of Mark, he is what can best be described as a PR genius. He's publicised global entertainment properties such as Cirque du Soleil, Prince, Iron Maiden, Led Zeppelin and the Three Tenors. He launched Stomp, which I have seen myself, it's very good, and has consistently taken on left-field projects that no one else would dare to touch. He did the PR for one of my favourite comedians, Eddie Izzard, and has handled a swathe of TV dramas and comedy shows from Our Friends in the North and Cracker to Spooks, which I love, and never mind the Buzzcocks. Now he helps companies adapt to new communication challenges. His company analyses communication problems, creates practical plans with creative strategies, and helps you to find the tools to execute that plan. Welcome, Mark. I'm really delighted that you can be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, as they say.
As they say, indeed. So, first things first, in a world gone mad with internet memes, can you add to the insanity for a moment and tell us a bit about the story of the tap dancing dog?
Oh God! I think we should cut to that at the end. I'm not going to give my—I'm not going to give my bet gag away. There's got to be some context to it. Never line up. The only thing people are likely to laugh about.
All right. Talk
seriously for a moment. Actually.
Okay. So should we revisit that right at the end then?
Yeah, I think we should.
All right.
A good full stop.
Okay. So in that case, let's start here. So, how does your background in arts and entertainment provide what I'd think of as quite a unique set of skills in the business world? Because I'd imagine it'd be really rather helpful.
My apprenticeship in theatre taught me a number of lessons. Mm. Perhaps the most important one was the power of the word of mouth. As a theatre publicist working in fringe theatre, you had no money. So therefore, you had to have as much free stuff as possible. And of course, that at the time was local newspapers, radio and TV. And to get them engaged, one had to, you know, obviously give them great angles. And if you got them engaged with the story, they give you lots of coverage. And that coverage ultimately would engage people and get people talking about the show. I discovered at the theatre, the most powerful viral marketeers were the, before people even using that term, the cleaners. Mm. They cared about what was going on stage. And they took ownership. So if there was coverage in the press, these people who, in their daily lives, touching places like your local shop, your laundrette, the bus, were talking about it. They would talk to the postman about it. But it had to be a strong story. And some of the problem areas was always the poor productions, because people quickly found out what they didn't like. So I just parlayed that in as I did more and more. I began to understand that the brands also had to produce powerful stories as well to generate people talking about it. And although we're millions of people are now bringing out books or connecting themselves to brand storytelling, it's always been a central theme of what I have always operated, of what captivates people. And that's every great publicist has sort of understood and known that and used the technology of the age, whether it's the radio or the telegraph in its infancy or even the printed word, to get people engaged with it. And even more so now, is it important that the competitive nature, particularly in tech and in travel, those are the best stories win, but they have to be truthful. Advertising folk are very good at delivering inwardly looking ideas of stuff they think is interesting, but they're not the core of what you do. And entertainment, you know, taught me that. So that's a very long answer to a very short question.
And I think it's a wonderful question, and a wonderful answer, rather. And I think one thing that you touched on that particularly struck me is the idea of truth, that you can weave a story as long as it's based on perhaps a wider truth. Can you expand on that a little bit?
I think we have, this is very much, you know, become prominent within an age when we're going through antitrust. I think the audience have feel duped. Social media has such a power now, you know, for people, you know, to make their views known. You know, the very best brands in social media are talking to their audience, and that's very difficult to do, particularly if your train is late, or you know, you're a gas company, you raise your prices again. So before all that existed, I think many brands could obfuscate, could hide underneath, put their hat on, avoid the question. And now we are beginning to see that we care about where a brand produces its goods. You know, if it is going to be in a sweatshop, we care So that's been a gradual change over the last 10 to 15 years, that there is no hiding place.
Yeah.
And the value of people's, that they invest in these sort of brands must be reciprocated. You can't cheat people. You can't confuse people. If you do, you get found out. And so a lot of brands are going right back to basics. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking what at the core of their business, how they operate, how they treat their staff, how they really, really, you know, provide value to their customers. And that's what we're all looking for in cash-strapped times, is great value and a great brand we can buy into. And, of course, you know, hero brands such as Virgin or Innocent Smoothies in the old days, you know, grew very quickly because they were facing their customers in such a way that the values were not fake, were not made up, were not phony, they were real.
Do you think there's an issue there? Because I was reading, I think it was yesterday, about, you know, stories about brands getting bought up by conglomerates. So, for instance, Innocent getting bought out by Coca-Cola or whoever it might be, or Green and Black's getting bought out by Nestle or something to that effect. What do you think happens when the story which starts out heroic and the brand that starts out as a kind of an underdog, or like the David to the Goliath of the conglomerates, what happens when they become taken over by these conglomerates? What happens to the story then?
Well, it's always down to the founders. You know, Ben and Jerry's is a classic example. You know, Cadbury's recently, you know, its long-standing history, now it's been bought up by Kraft. It's very difficult. Mm. I mean, I sit down with chief executives now and say, you know, and what's your plan? And somebody will hit you with a business plan over a year or even 4 or 5 years. And then you say, what's it for? Now, you know, share value, you know, a public company. And you pursue and pursue and pursue and you realize that, you know, you're a custodian of a brand for a certain amount of time, and the legacy is where the consumers buy into it. So it's very tough when someone's sold out and, you know, work extremely hard, sometimes starting something from nothing, you know, taken, you know, huge sacrifices in their life. They probably do want to retire on that. And it's very difficult for a big conglomerate to come along and try and carry forward those values, because it again gets in the hands sometimes of venture capitalists, and they want to derive value from that. And the values that they see do not match it with the founders. And I think that's why some companies, you know, who we have hero worship for, do disappear. It's a natural cycle of life, I guess. And that's why I'm always fascinated by, you know, family businesses. I mean, Richard Sounds at the moment, you know, Richard's setting up a foundation for his workers, wants to hand it over to his staff. And that's probably at a personal sacrifice to himself. Probably can get more if it's sold out to anywhere else. So I'm always interested in founders and people of what they do next. And that's quite a tough journey to go on. Mm. Sometimes it's not something that the audience or the customers embrace, because that's where it goes.
So what are some of the communication problems that companies are having? So not just the large ones, because I think obviously the large ones suffer from their own set of issues, but one of the things that you say on your website is that companies don't have the impact that they want, because either the message is right and the delivery is wrong, or, you know, the message itself is wrong. Can you talk a bit about these two errors?
I think a lot of companies do the wrong things really, really well. Partly from that is it's always about structure and process. Mm. It's about investment in great people and staff, and sometimes they could be trapped in an echo chamber. They could be listening to the sound of their own voice. I think it's difficult for brands now because everybody is selling everything that is new. Everybody's got to be mobilize their business. The impact of sort of mobile technology and mobile web is huge at the moment, and some brands are leaping into the social space and digital space without really a proper plan, and also strong leadership. And of course, the speed of change, the disruptive times of going through of what someone could make a lot of money on in the software world one year is free the next.
Mm.
And I remember a lesson taught me from a client who came in. I was calling me like every hour of the day or night, obsessing. And I said, "Steve, slow down. I mean, I've got to get some sleep here." And he said, while you and I are sleeping, Mark, someone in another part of the world is developing a similar idea. And I thought, well, that's quite interesting. So on one level, the speed of change is not allowing people to sit back and think. It's not creating fantastic leadership. Everybody's diving into new without thinking the consequences of it. We're being told by, management consultants that it's a waste of time to gaze out of the window. We need space and time. And that isn't something that is a dichotomy of having to be fearful of the audience, fearful of the crowd. I mean, one of the things I fully believe in is actually learning from your haters.
Yeah.
Because you'll always have people who do not like your product. If you spend your time trying to fixate them, I think one of the most hated brands still carries on ferrying millions of people through the skies, which is Ryanair.
Mm.
And you see brands in crisis and they face up to it, but they're still going. So I think it's getting that plan and getting the right people around you to activate that plan, and not being sucked into the process of outside help from consultants or marketeers or whatever to just process you through. I think you've got to ask a lot more now of people that involve yourself with the business, and your problems can usually, and your development comes from internally, from great people you have internally. So it's how brands develop their voice internally and how they engage with their staff.
And how do you think, what are some of the ways that you've seen companies do that well?
The one thing I think that I've seen well is actually when you've got a very thoughtful and considered chief executive or a very strong board who are in it for the long haul.
Mm.
I think within any brand or any business life, my own business life, there's no 5 or 3 year plan. The gun metal stormy skies greet you some days have to be dealt with. It's not in the rose of the world. So you're in it for a long, long journey. And the majority of people who I think do well are family businesses who hand the business down, and it's a difficult thing to do. But I think there is some vested interest in the passion and the blood, sweat and tears that's gone in from generation to generation. And I think that's where the level of service comes from and the level of detail that goes into the program. Other brands, I'm a great fan, not of the product, but of the attitude of Red Bull. I think that they're fearless and they've surrounded an idea and created content. And they've done some rather amazing things which match what they stand for, you know, wings, speed and flight. And I thought that the edge of space jump was quite an extremely risky moment. Yeah. So I always genuflect towards the Mavericks, and I'm developing a thought process now called adventure capitalism, where it is very important for people to contemplate living each day and keeping in touch with their day and not planning too far for the future, because we're not there. If you're not enjoying the day, if you're not being tactile and not being, you know, close to what you're doing, you don't feel what you're doing, you lose a certain sense of joy. Brands who facilitate that and get the best out of their staff is something that I can really connect to.
I love the idea of adventure capitalism and the sense of you know, risk-taking, but a different kind of risk-taking. Because I think one of the things that you mentioned about earlier, which was when, you know, the notions or the core values or the passion with which founders start and sacrifice for their businesses then gets lost when eventually they perhaps make a success of their business and they decide to take a different path and maybe retire and hand over. That venture capitalists do take risks in certain ways, but maybe it's not the kind of risks that they should be taking that add to the story, that add to the value of the brand to the customers, that ensure that kind of longevity and that the word of mouth keeps going. What do you think are ways in which, or do you think it's possible to teach people or to create a culture of venture capitalism that embraces a more founder-like mindset?
Yes, there is. I mean, there is a very definite process, and it's something that that is part of my business now in actually creating those structures of allowing people to understand and how that works. There's some other great companies out there doing it. You know, Group Partners and John Castle is doing a fantastic set of new thinking. There are people out there, but there's got to be a certain willingness to go through that change. And it can be quite tough because it's not a negative factor, but you do have to have fundamental questions of yourself. And I do it. I do a session where I take people on a walk, and we walk around to cities, particularly cities that I've got connected work to, and I go through some of the bold decisions people have actually made that have changed their business. Or has actually got them out of the set of thinking, but that takes time. And if you're going to give half a day to that sort of process to actually think, it starts a chain reaction of ideas that sometimes is very difficult to see through. I think there's a lot of consultants out there providing thinking and stuff, but then they hand it back to the structure of the organisation and they can't do it, because there's very few people then who lead companies through by the hand actually to the suggestive changes that have been made. And we've seen, I touched on technology earlier, but some of the technology stresses that brands like Sony have faced, if you think about how they invented the original Walkman, which was which was a cassette version, but somehow never saw the MP3 coming along, which sounds incredible. Brands can actually get stuck and they stop and they think they've done enough, but it's a constant state of change. So in terms of the idea of venture capitalism is to actually think about getting those creative and disruptive thoughts as part of it, just to be an examination point of what you're doing in your own personal life, to cherish the time you have on this planet.
It sounds like you have, I'm smiling because you're making me feel good talking about sort of the wider picture. So you've mentioned joy and about making the most of the time that one has on this planet and having a tactile sense of each day and not planning too much into the future. And I think to me, it sort of taps into an existential point. This idea of the fact that being so connected now and having plans and everything being so fast paced, like the chap who said, while we're sleeping, someone somewhere is having an idea that we wish we could have, or maybe we could work through to have. That there seems to be such a frenetic rush that no one's really just stopping to smell the roses and taking the time to have those moments of rest, which is when those creative ideas actually happen. Do you think that maybe we're missing out?
I totally agree. And I think that there was, in the downturn, post 2008, 2009, when people really have to reevaluate, there was a crash around us, and the same thing happened around my business. I had the time to reevaluate. But as soon as events pick up again, we seem to forget it.
Yeah.
We seem to forget the important things. So I think, memory of, at the end of the day, there's we all must remember and learn from our mistakes. And it's incredible how we can all sleepwalk back into making exactly the same repetitive behavior to make those mistakes.
Mm.
So it's not just time to be creative. It's time to sort of remember how and where we got to that sort of place. And I've seen far too many people who have, I think today I've seen two people who, both sold their respective businesses and want to get back in to the same sort of business. And the question you have to ask is why? And is it because of the amount of fun we had, which had to change? And I said, what have you done with all the sort of money that you've made? Well, I don't really know. Bought a house and played a bit of extra golf, bought a Ferrari or whatever. Did that fulfill you? No.
Mm.
And you realize that they want to get back and recreate what they should never have sold it, because very few people can, particularly, in as we're getting younger, as we're getting older in some ways in our head, can ever really retire properly.
Yeah.
Unless you're doing something totally different and it's giving you that sort of challenge to do something constructive with the time in your hands. Mm-hmm. Because busy executives find it very, very difficult to replace that frenetic change in life. And experience is needed where we genuflect to youth. That many of those businesses have engineered out great experience. I think that's partly to do with the crash we've had in newspapers and the antitrust in newspapers, because certain people at 40 becoming far too expensive. You get rid of those and get a young, fast, creative young journalist in place who perhaps doesn't have the life skills and experience of knowing what to chase down on a story. So I think that you've got to get that balance. You've got to get that balance right. And I think that going back to this idea of the adventure or whatever, you've got to settle on, not just where you're going at this moment or beyond. And I think more and more brands, as we come out of perhaps in more of an economic lift in America and the UK at the moment, are slipping back, and they're forgetting what it was like 5 or 6 years ago. They've engineered themselves out of that, but beginning to forget the lessons of that torpid time.
It's really frustrating. I'm not a huge fan of reading copious tomes of history, but I do watch films or documentaries on the subject, and I think it's one of those things where we're very myopic in our sense of patterning. The idea that every time you go through something, it's a little bit like a goldfish bowl. You go through one cycle, and then you promptly forget what you've just done, and you forget what the generations before have been through, and then you just end up caught in this, this kind of vicious cycle that you're just not even aware of after a point. Do you think let me ask you your personal experience of this. What do you do to stop yourself from making mistakes that you've observed yourself making?
You've got to find that time for self. You've got to find that time for reflection. You've really got to put it in, which is really quite difficult to do. So I have an absolute firm rule that I have one day a week out of the office, where I get out of the office and I work from home, and I'm in a sort of monastic cell, and that time is used well to plow through the inbox and deal with the stuff I didn't do, but actually make quality decisions about the forthcoming week. I think that it's tough because things are crashing in all the time. But the one thing is size. It's about being effective in business with your size, because I think it can be, and also importantly, you've got to be able to say no.
No.
Yes is the easiest word, no is shorter, but we tend not to use it. And because we're we have to take the immediate, and we have to deal with that immediate email. You know, once upon a time, you know, it didn't have that sort of constant speed of connection coming through some social feed, your inbox, and messages and whatever. So as much space you can give to be able to be strong, to be able to say no, is vital. And choosing, and perhaps really questioning about everything that you do, that client, that life decision, is it the right decision? And sometimes we've all got involved with absolutely the wrong client because we thought it was a good client to work for, and maybe we've been bewitched by the budget. And sometimes the most effective and more interesting clients come with a smaller budget, but you can do great work that leads on to other things. So getting that balance all the time to keep away from slipping in or sleepwalking, as I described it, into making the wrong decisions.
So interesting talking with you. I'd love to have a bit more of an existential chat about this, because it's just such a, I think it's an approach that your approach to life then permeates into your business, and everything benefits from it.
I love my job. I was very lucky. You know, I was very lucky. You know, a man who really sort of urinated, you know, his youthful arrogance opportunities away, and thought everything was owed to him. And at the time, my father died. I didn't get the necessary grades to get into my university of choice, and everything fell apart. And it was that really significant moment, my father's death, that I thought, like, you know, got to get out there and do something. I can't have this fairy tale youthful, you know, life going on. And it was there that I fell in, you know, after a couple of, you know, port speeches into theatre. And when I got grabbed by theatre and grabbed with people, you know, it was an opportunity that I really, really took. When you love something, what better than to come in every day? Not every day is a great day. Get me wrong, I have some really tough days sometimes, and really some frustrating days. Mm. But on the whole, I thoroughly enjoy what I do. I can't imagine, so, you know, I can't even imagine how I would retire or what I would do, because every day is very interesting. Every day somebody walks into my life who's got an interesting story, and part of the venture capitalism talk is the time when the guy called up, my executive assistant took a phone call, so he got to speak to this man, and I took it, and he was a bank manager from Carmarthen, a Barclays bank manager from Carmarthen. He thought he had, doing a stock take in a long forgotten safety deposit box, he thought he'd actually got the Holy Grail. And would I come down and actually take a look at it, and maybe we could put a plan of how we'd exploit the story and get the news out across the world, you know, because he was convinced the Holy Grail. Well, of course, you know, as I was heading for the door, someone called me back and said, "Where are you going, Mark?" And I said, "Go to Carmarthen. There's a bank manager that's got the Holy Grail in his vault." And they said, "No, you're not, Mark. We've got the pitch for Bisto today."
Oh, God.
And my life would come down to this, you know, the Grail or gravy granules.
Oh, God.
You
know?
So I had to make a decision. And, you know, and all those things, that whole idea of quantum physics and the parallel universes, going on to philosophy again, you know, we make a decision. It's a very definitive, you know, T-junction every day. We take a left and we take a right. You can't go back. There's no way. You have no reverse gear. You've got to keep going right or left. And right or left sometimes is the right decision and the wrong decision. And that's what makes it absolutely fascinating. That sort of danger that you will likely make the wrong decision fuels the energy that you can always make the right decision as well.
Oh, this is very inspiring. I think I'm going to have you on a panel all to myself over a glass of wine, and we can do a video interview. I feel sort of a bit naughty sort of bringing it down to the tap dancing dog, but I did promise we'd revisit it. So Mark, can you tell us a little bit about this now famous tap dancing dog?
Yeah, it's I've got to come up with a strong argument that I use it in a lot of my talks because I go into some pretty dark stuff about how we're manipulated now and how if you think about some of the darkest people in the universe actually use terrible things to manipulate us. So usually the audience has gone right down, so I have to lift them up, and it always engages people, and it's absolutely true story. This is not made up. That back in my theatre days, I was working at a very famous theatre, the Theatre Royal Stratford East, that was made famous by Joe Littlewood and the Theatre Workshop. I had a pretty tough boss at the time who actually was addicted to the headlines they used to generate for the theatre to get audiences in. And he came up with what actually at the time was a pretty poor idea, believe it or not, which was an amateur variety night.
Right.
And the idea is local people, I mean, it was a precursor thought to Britain's Got Talent in many ways. Mm. But I couldn't ever drum up enough coverage on it in local newspapers. The New York Recorder used to sort of say, oh, God, no, not that. Don't want to know. He said, come with a relevant, interesting story, Mark, and I'll be interested. So I went away and I was getting some grief from my boss. And I was looking out the window and I thought, I know what. And I said, let's have a dog. Dancing dog. And I think it was inspired as a kid by watching Esther Anson's That's Life. Anyway, so I called him up and I literally made it up on the spot. I made this tap dancing dog story up on the spot. I said, Neil, you never believe. We've had, oh, what is it? I said, a dog. Tell me more. I said, dances. How does it dance? Is it tap dances? And he said, how? And I'd not really thought it through. And I don't know what part of my left or right side of the brain came up with the idea. I said, well, it's got little silver shoes on its feet. And it dances to the theme tune, the streets of San Francisco. And so I'm coming down now.
Love it.
I said, not now. I said, not now. I said, you know, I've got to get the dog in. It's in Upminster or something. So I had to find a dog. So I found a dog and I found an actress to hold this sort of dog. Pictures came. It made the front page, you know, tap dancing dog gets his big break on variety nights. And of course, I thought the phones would be ringing off the hook if people wanted to come along. I never thought how I was going to pull it off quite, but it sort of got out of hand. Anyway, way before, sort of email, this journalist was very smart. He went on to do great things. But in his enthusiasm to make a name for himself, he sold the story around the world. And I came back to TV crews from America, Russia, China, all wanted to come to the tap dancing dog. So I was stuffed. I thought that was it. My lie would be found out. So I quickly found out. I said, bad news, Neil. He said, what? I said, bad news. I said, the tap dancing dog's dead. So he said, how? And at that moment, my office looked out onto the busy one-way system in Stratford.
Yeah.
And I saw a refrigerated lorry come by. I said, it got run over by a refrigerated lorry. He said, where? And the only place I could think about was where I was living at the time, Windmill Lane. So the story ran. Tap dancing dog, run over Windmill Lane. Now, I thought that was it. It made the front page. I got out of jail. Lots of coverage for Variety Night and whatever. What I didn't realise was the good residents of Newham, and particularly around Windmill Lane, was trying to get heavy goods vehicles stopped from using the cut-through on Windmill Lane to beat the traffic. So 2 weeks later, at a protest at the Newham Town Hall, and there were banners. And the banner was tap dancing dog today, children tomorrow.
Wow.
So the dog became an icon, and I'm happy to report there was a good news story at the end of it. Because of the tap dancing dog getting run over at Windmill Lane, they banned heavy goods vehicles from using it. So lives were saved.
Wow, amazing. By a mythical tap dancing dog. I love that story. It's just such a great story. Oh, what do you think about it is that makes it so persuasive?
What is it? Well, you can probably still find in a remainder shot some of my first book, which was called The History of the Publicity Stunt, called it Propaganda History of the Publicity Stunt. I wanted to see, you know, if a picture could be worth 7,000 words.
Wow.
And under one of the sections was animals. And as we know, the internet is driven by funny cats.
Oh, yes.
Dogs, elephants, water skiing elephants, horses that can jump. It just captivated. So at the core of it is an animal. And the core of it is that emotion. It's got all the sort of triggers that engage people. And everybody has the idea of a tap dancing dog in their head. You want to see it. And that was the art of some of the great publicists who used to work in in the circus world. They took their ideas onto the street, or they played with those ideas, and they created the theatre of the mind. And I think some, you know, pre the internet, where you could check up everything, I think that was a very important sort of tool. That, you know, that there was a very famous picture of one of the Penny Dreadfuls, the original tabloid papers in America, and they printed a scene. You look at it now, it's an incredible picture of scene from life on the moon. This is in Victorian times. And there's all these sort of terribly badly handwritten. It was meant to be taken for this world's most powerful telescope. and of course, it sold thousands, hundreds of thousands. When the rival publication outed it as a lie, and it was a completely made up, it sold even more people trying to get it the next day.
Wow.
So it's people's curiosity has to be excited.
I'm going to bring us down to a sort of a different playful level now. I've got a quick fire round, which are five either or questions. Are you ready to play?
I'll try.
All right, so tap dancing cat or tap dancing dog?
Now cat.
Okay. Starter or dessert?
Always starter, because I'm on a diet.
All right, certainty or adventure?
Adventure.
Present or future?
Present or future? Present.
I always thought there might be a dialogue going on in there. Okay, beer or cocktails?
Oh, beer.
Wicked. Thanks, Mark. Well, I've really, really enjoyed chatting with you today and hearing about all of your interesting thoughts and your work and your stories. If you're listening and you want to ask Mark any more questions, which I'm sure you probably will, you can find him on Twitter at Mark Borkowski using the hashtag GoodBadDirty. And I will also put up the link for his website, which is borkowski.do, as well as...
Blog, I may mention my blog too.
Oh, yes, no, please do. What do you want people to check out?
My blog is, which comes out twice a week, is www.markborkowski.com. So that's my personal blog. So that's I exchange some ideas there. I'm available for hire for inspirational bar mitzvahs.
And for kids parties, probably.
Do you know what? I could never ever make a balloon animal. I've been on courses, but they never. That's a big thing. And I'm allergic to clown makeup. So.
Oh dear. That's one calling that has eluded you so far. Well, Mark, thank you so much. I'll put the link up to your blog as well. And thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you, Natalie, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you like this episode, make sure you go to my website, thewebpsychologist.com/show-notes, to get links to all the resources we mentioned, as well as updates on future shows. Thanks for listening.